This week on Making Contact.
I mean, the poverty rate, on the one hand, has gone down, but people have to remember that the official poverty rate is $16,665, I think, for four people. And that will get you very, very little. In fact, there's a whole debate about the poverty line, the official poverty line.
They haven't been on the streets. It might have reached its all-time low because they're sitting in an office about 20 stories up. Come down to the streets and come into the right areas. You'll see what all-time low it is. When they say the all-time low, do they mean low as far as stopping poverty?
This fall, the Clinton administration released a report from the Census Bureau claiming that poverty is at a 20-year low. Nonetheless, over 34 million Americans live below the poverty line. On this program, you'll hear from some of the people who aren't prospering from the so-called economic boom. We also examine some of the roots and cycles of poverty in the United States. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. On Saturday, October 2nd, 1999, the National Coalition for the Homeless kicked off a new campaign, the Civil Rights Organizing Project. That day, the coalition held public events in several major metropolitan areas to call attention to the homeless crisis in the United States. Although the homeless population fluctuates and is difficult to measure, homelessness is increasing, according to many studies, including a 1998 U.S. Conference of Mayors survey. The survey included 30 urban areas and found that requests for emergency shelter increased by 11% over the previous year, and that more than one out of four homeless people were turned away from shelters. The coalition's campaign event in San Francisco called attention to a variety of issues, including the fact that homeless people are dying in our streets. Paul Bowden is co-chair of the National Coalition's Civil Rights Organizing Project.
In this building, you see, we've got a banner up about deaths, about homeless people that are dying in the streets. That's where this stems from. We have nothing to lose. We are dying. What more can they take from you than your life? You know, they go after your spirit, they go after your dignity, they go after your ability to determine for yourself what you're going to do, and then they let you die in the streets. They can take nothing from us because they are already killing us, so we have nothing to lose by standing up and saying, we are not going to be nice and polite and do a report and hope that you accept it and call us experts. That doesn't do anything. What you have to do is be willing to stand up and say, first, you're going to look me in the eye. You are going to treat me like an equal. You are going to treat me like with respect because I demand it, not because I ask for it. And if enough of us from our little funky little street newspapers, from our taking over airwaves with our independent liberation radio stations, with our manipulating the media, if we are saying the same thing, we create the national dialogue. If enough of us in New York, San Francisco, Berkeley, Jeffersonville, Indiana, if we're all saying the same thing, all of a sudden I've heard it in one place, I've heard it in another place, I've heard it in another place. Hey, that must be a national dialogue. And the dialogue is, we demand respect. Thank you.
But the national dialogue Bowden spoke of seemed a little skewed that day. As it turned out, the U.S. Census Bureau had released its poverty report 2 days earlier. Front page stories in the national press claimed that so-called welfare reform was working and that the average American was making more money these days, a notable contrast to the calls for economic justice in cities across the country. We asked Joel Blau, author of Illusions of Prosperity and The Visible Poor, Homelessness in the United States, to give us his perspective on the latest poverty statistics from the Clinton administration.
Well, I think to some extent there have been some gains. I think that the data that you just mentioned is kind of exaggerating them in terms of the way they measure what's going on with most working people. The fact of the matter is that four-fifths of the U.S. population has been has less after-tax income over the last 20 or 25 years, if you reflect inflation in this, calculate inflation in this. Most of the gains have been concentrated in the upper fifth and even more intensely in the upper 5% and 1%. People are not doing as well as one would think, although certainly they're doing better than they have in a while.
Yeah, what does exactly median income really mean? I think the number they use is $38,500 for a family of four. What does that get you these days?
Well, it might get you a fairly comfortable living in some small towns in, let's say, the South. But if you are a family of four in a major American city, you're going to be cutting corners on $38,000 a year. And even more so, I mean, you mentioned the poverty rate. I mean, the poverty rate, on the one hand, has gone down, but people have to remember that the official poverty rate is $16,665, I think, for four people. And that will get you very, very little. In fact, there's a whole debate about the official poverty line. What basically happened was in the 1960s, the federal government established the poverty line at $3,000 a year, which was supposed to be, they said temporary food would cost $1,000 in 1965, and food was one-third of the average family's budget. So they established a poverty line of $3,000. And all that has happened between the $3,000 figure that I mentioned from the mid-1960s to the current poverty line is they've added inflation. Now, there are all sorts of ways in which that distorts the cost of food, which has gone down, regional differences, and just the plain, frank, and brutal question of whether one can be an active participant and have a decent standard of living with four people and $16,000 a year.
Yeah, I just used the calculator to figure out what that exactly means. That's about $4 per hour for two adults in that household working 50 out of 52 weeks, 40 hours a week. That doesn't leave much time for anything else, and that really isn't that much money either. Are people really getting by on that much money?
Well, I don't think they are. I mean, I don't see how one could. And the other question, which I think you raised, which is really important, is the spillover effects of trying to maintain your standard of living. I mean, one of the things that we have in this country is a really desperate effort on a lot of people to work harder and longer, often for less money or certainly not wages that haven't quite kept up with inflation for most people over the last 20 or 25 years. And what that's done is drain parental caretaking resources from the family. We still have a social policy model that reflects the assumption that women are going to stay home and the man is going to be the breadwinner, and indeed that his salary is going to be sufficient to support everybody. I'm not saying women should go back to the home. I want to be real clear about that. What I'm saying is that we do not have social policies in this country that reflect the real changing circumstances of families and the real changed economy in which we all live and work.
Let's get back to some of these numbers. The Census Bureau is quite pleased. I don't mean to editorialize too much, but these statistics are kind of astounding how they're reporting them, that the number of people living below the poverty line dropped from about 35.6 million to 34.5 million, a drop of about 1.1 million people. That's a lot of people, though. That's over 10% of the U.S. population.
Yes, it is. I think the official statistic, I believe, is 12.9. I think in the latest.
I believe so. Yes,
yeah,
12.7.
12.7, right? In the latest data, it was, I believe, at its height up to about 15.3 or something like that in the worst years of the Reagan depression or recession in 1982-83. So it has come down. But I think what you're seeing is a splitting of American society where some people are doing fabulously well, and the people who are not, their poverty is really, really intense. If you look, I think, within that statistic, if you look at the number of people who have 50% of the poverty line, you'll see a growth in that number. So if somebody's on this scale earning only $8,000, their family's only earning $8,000 a year, you'll see actual growth in the number of people only earning $8,000 a year. So what we have is increasing this bifurcation of American society into the fabulously wealthy and the desperately poor. And also, I think if you broaden that out, I think you can say, despite much of what goes on in the popular media, the broad middle class have done not so well either. In fact, if you combine the bottom 20% and the middle 60, you'll see that they have, in fact, been downwardly mobile over much of the last 25 years.
You know, the national press reported these statistics over the weekend, October 2nd and 3rd, and they presented the argument that welfare reform is working, that these numbers do verify that. What's your take on whether welfare reform, so-called welfare reform, is working or not?
Well, the program is doing better. It's only the people who are doing worse. We have developed tunnel vision on all of these matters, many of these matters. We're so concerned about getting the numbers down and getting the costs down that we track what's happening to the program, but we stop tracking what's happened to the people. My understanding of the most recent research on welfare reform is that about half the people who've left welfare have gotten jobs that pay about $6.50 an hour, or about $13,000 a year, which is obviously not on welfare, but it's below the poverty line. And we don't know what's happened to the other 50%, so who are presumably not doing as well and have just been lost. And to show you the bias of the standard, the criteria that we're talking about, nobody's interested in tracking them, because clearly if the best are only getting $6.50 an hour, the people who aren't being tracked are probably even doing worse. So I have serious doubts about welfare reform. And I should point out that this is under what are, for purposes of welfare reform, ideal circumstances. That is, everybody says this is the best the economy has been in 30 years. Now, welfare reform was implemented in 1997. There's a five-year limit nationally, and in some states even less than that, I believe. That means that if there is a recession after 2002, a lot of people are going to be in really bad trouble. And 2002 is going to begin to look a lot like 1932 before there was some kind of federal welfare system.
You know, the National Coalition for the Homeless held a national strategy event, coordinated events across the country this past weekend, as you know. And one of their key elements they presented as far as trying to present the situation of homeless people to the public is that there's a vicious cycle of poverty that involves this criminalization that you're describing. That is, homeless people are shuffled off of a park bench. They're given a ticket. They can't pay the ticket. They end up in jail for 72 hours if they had any sort of job during that time period. That is gone. So in a sense, they're kind of locked into this poverty cycle because of this criminalization. Are those stories that we're hearing from the homeless people the same stories that you're encountering in your research?
Yes, they are. Because the problem is that housing is supposed to be essentially something that is operated for profit. You can't be too generous in the society without violating one of the basic principles of its operation, in the economic sphere anyway, that things have to make money. So you want people off the street, so people put them in shelters or put them in a group home or something temporarily, and then they can't get anywhere. They can't get any traction. And the problem is that the same causes the causes of homelessness are also the obstacles to to doing anything about it. If you want to change housing policy, or you believe that housing costs are one of the causes of homelessness, then you encounter the constraint, the obstacle that housing is for profit, and generally speaking, homeless people are too poor to make a profit from. If you believe that, as the other half of this, homeless people do not have enough money, they're not earning enough money, they're incapable of making enough money because they have something the matter with them, they should be receiving assistance, well, that runs into the same analogous obstacle in the job market, namely that low wages are help companies make money, and below low wages have to be low welfare. Otherwise, why would anybody bother to go to work? There has to be a differential between the two. So I would maintain that the housing market and the labor market are still fundamental causes of homelessness, and we haven't dealt with that, even though we may be trying very very diligently to get people off the street.
I wonder if you have any thoughts on the timing of the release of this U.S. Census Bureau report that claimed that poverty was at a 20-year low.
Actually, the Bureau of the Census does these reports, I think, pretty much every August or September, so I don't think that there's anything more than this is their regular annual report on income data. What I will say on this, poverty in this country once meant that you had a roof over your head. Homelessness means that the poor were downwardly mobile. That is, they were poor without a roof overhead. That happened beginning in the late 70s and early 80s. The downward mobility of the poor foreshadowed the downward mobility and the growing economic insecurity of the vast majority of Americans in the 80s and increasingly in the 90s. This economic insecurity is reflected in both the difficulty in getting wages to keep up with inflation and in the inadequacy of social programs that used to provide some social protection, some social supports for people who are having a difficult time of it.
Well, I've been speaking with Joel Blau. Joel, thanks for joining us and making contact.
My pleasure.
Joel Blau is a professor at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. His most recent book is titled Illusions of Prosperity, America's Working Families in an Age of Economic Insecurity.
If you want more information about the subject of this week's show, call the National Radio Project. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, 800-529-5736.
As homelessness increases, so do the number of laws and ordinances directed at homeless people. Anti-loitering laws, anti-panhandling laws, and limits on how closely someone can stand or sit near an ATM machine, to name a few. Tony Taylor, a formerly homeless person who is now with the New York Coalition for the Homeless, says that laws such as these add to the cycle of poverty.
Well, I had became homeless back in 1985. Back then, I had a bit of depression from a lot of deaths in my family and everything, and I entered the shelter system there. Upon entering the shelter system, I noticed that they were just pretty much shoving people around any way they wanted. So on the third day, I was in probably the worst shelter in the male system in New York. They were putting us out saying it's a fire drill from 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock. 12 o'clock, we re-enter the shelter, and they say they're going to throw us out after lunch until dinner time. So I stirred up about 60 guys in the facility, telling them that they can't throw us out like that. We came here for assistance, so they couldn't throw us out. So I staged a sit-in, and we sat in, we waited. 2 o'clock came, they decided to let us in. It was right then and there I noticed that the one thing we're doing is we're letting them do things to us. We just have to stand up and stop letting them abuse us.
So this was a city-run shelter?
Yes. Yes, city-run.
What were the conditions of the shelter anyway?
Jail-like. Jail. It was jail-like. I have some familiar.
But tell us about one day and one night.
Okay, one day you'd be asleep and you'd wake up and guys would be cutting guys with razors, fighting. House gang is what I'd call them. They call themselves whatever they want, but it was a house gang. Would be taking guys' money, take their clothing if they had new clothing, beat them up, cut them with razors, and security, which was supposed to be in there, would just leave and let everything happen.
And what were you doing during this time?
At that time, I started looking at that particular incident, and I said, we need to get some guys together here and sign petitions and things. So I got together some petitions, because we didn't have clean drinking water. The place was a mess. Still is a mess. It's probably in worse condition than when I left. And I got the petition signed, and then I kept about 50 guys with me who were pretty cool. And I tried to stop the house gang from beating on people as much as I could, if I was in their area or if I was in at that particular time. But it was rough.
And then how did you get involved with the National Coalition on Homelessness?
I actually got involved with the New York Coalition because I was transferred to a shelter that was taken over by a private industry in the city. The industry had guys working, and they had them paying rent for their stay in a shelter. So we were challenging the fact that, why are we paying rent? And we have to sign for our beds, and we have to come in on curfew, and if we miss curfew, you'll take our bed from us, but we're paying rent. I don't understand. We didn't understand that. So a lawsuit was brought up. We made a big stink about it and everything, and the guy got pretty mad. I ended up staging a walkout with the workers. Because at the time, I was fighting for their rights continually. I was the client advisory board president, so I'd fight for their rights continually. If they did something to try to transfer these guys illegally, I'd go stop it. If they did something to take away these guys' money for no reason, I'd go stop it. Anything that was I thought was wrong, I'd go and stop it.
Let me ask you this. Why do you think that the publicly run shelter and the private run shelter, why are they harassing poor people? Why are they making it difficult for poor people to just get along and try to survive?
For repetition. If I don't harass you and keep you at a bad frame of mind, somewhere along the line you're going to leave this place and everything's going to be cool. But if I keep harassing you and keep your head off of what you have to do with yourself, because they will harass you in ways when you're going to school to try to get yourself improved, when you're working, they'll try to sabotage your jobs. I used to inform my clients that, listen, fellas, don't give them the vital information of your job. Write it out. All you need is your name, your social security number, and the fact that you are working, which is your pay stub. You just write out everything else. Cover it all up. Don't give them all the information because they will sabotage you, keep you there.
And what do they have to lose if you leave?
Dollars. Huge dollars. It's big business. Huge dollars. I've looked at all the dollars that's going around because I had gotten a copy of a contract once, and it was just amazing. The money that's being wasted. Really wasted. When all you can do, you can take that same money and you can have affordable housing for anyone, any one of those guys. The money that you spend each month or each year, you can have affordable housing for the guy for 10, 20 years.
Give us a sense of what, how many dollars we're talking about. I mean, here in California, we pay $35,000 a year, Harvard tuition level, for housing prisoners in our prison system. What's it like for keeping people on welfare in New York?
In New York, it's like, and keep them in a homeless, it's a single adult, it would be like around $23,000 a year. Now, you take that same figure and the affordable rent for that single adult would be somewhere around $500 a month, which would make it $6,000. So sounds like something's wrong with the math here to me. I don't, maybe it's me, but it sounds like something's wrong to me.
Well, that's really interesting. I don't know if you had a chance to see the front page of USA Today. I happened to see it, and they were reporting on a statistic that said, this is out of the U.S. Census Bureau, that said that poverty had reached its 20-year all-time low. I'm wondering if you saw that headline, if you have any reactions to that figure.
They haven't been on the streets. It might have reached its all-time low because they're sitting in an office about 20 stories up. Come down to the streets and come into the right areas. You'll see what all-time low it is. When they say they're all-time low, do they mean low as far as stopping poverty? Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But no, it's not. I think it's at its all-time high myself.
Well, just to give you a sense of some of the statistics, they were considering poverty level $16,000 a year for a family of four. And I did the math that that's two working adults in a household. That's $4 an hour. They said that 1 million people had made more than $16,000 a year. That's families, and that's what they considered to be a decrease in poverty. But how's anyone supposed to get by on $16,000 a year?
A single adult couldn't even survive on $16,000 a year. Much a family? Forget it. I don't where these figures, how they figure this stuff out is beyond me. Maybe someone gives them a few dollars here. This is what we want you to say. I don't know what. That's impossible. There's no way a single adult can live on $16,000 a year. You'll be scratching by hand and tooth.
You're here from New York, and we're in San Francisco. We're at the National Coalition on Homelessness's event taking place here in downtown San Francisco. You're a press contact, and you're an organizer on homelessness. How's organizing going?
Pretty well right now, but I got a lot of work to do. It's really a lot of work. It's going to be a hell of a lot of work because as I'm organizing, they're changing laws and making things worse and worse, and it's just getting worse. So it's going to be a constant thing. I'm probably in this for life.
What sort of things do you look for when you begin organizing and talking to families and working people?
I try to find somebody with a strong enough mind so that they won't back down and they understand the injustices that's being done to them. Because if you don't understand what's being done to you, and if you're not strong of mind, able to stand before somebody and tell them exactly what they're doing to you, then you're going to come out the loser. So I have to, even if I don't find someone strong of mine, I'll try to instill that in them. Because, like I said, it's going to be a tough, tough fight. Tough one.
Well, thanks. Sounds like the speeches are starting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tony Taylor with the New York Coalition for the Homeless. The difficulties for homeless and poor people in dealing with public assistance systems and law enforcement agencies are not unique to New York, of course. A simple loitering ticket can cause great hardship for someone with little or no money and virtually no legal assistance. And rather than working toward getting out of poverty, a poor person may be forced to work toward paying a fine. Red is a homeless woman in San Francisco. She says just 1 year ago, when she first became homeless, emergency shelters almost always had beds or space available for women. Now 30 to 60 women a night, Red says, are turned away. When I interviewed her, she had just finished rolling her shopping cart away from two police officers who were asking her questions about it and starting to move along other homeless people. She says the night before she had been taken to jail with no explanation.
We sat down there, it was three women and there was one guy. We sat down in there for like 48 minutes. The door came open and said, "Get out of here and you better run fast or I'm going to charge you with something." That was it. I don't even know why we were taken down. That was wrong. It was wrong. I had another one of those little push cart things. Somebody stole that. It's not right, man. It's not right. That's why I was running down the hill like I was crazy trying to get my cart before they closed this thing off.
Oh, that just across the street right there just a few minutes ago?
Yeah. I came running down like I was going crazy. And please look out. Where are you going? Where are you going? I asked them, "What's going on here in the park?" I don't know. Get the hell out of here. Go on, move it. You know, they're wrong. They're
so when we crossed paths, you were just finishing talking
just
to the two police officers I saw there.
Just trying to get my stuff up out of there. "No, where are you going? You can't take that." I said, "It's my cart." "You didn't touch it yet. Don't I have the right to grab it and go before you lay your hand on it?" He said, "Get out of here." And I just ran across the street, and that's when I seen you coming down.
Do you mind if I ask you just a couple more questions?
Sure.
How long have you been homeless, if you don't mind me asking?
13 months. Yeah, 13 months, and just like, you try and get on Tenderloin housing or something like that. They say waiting is 4 years and up. You know, it's... I mean, and then these garbage hotel apartments are so small, big as your car, okay? They want $50 a day or like $900 a month. How are you going to do that on $140 every 2 weeks? You know, you can't do it. You can't do it at all.
Is that general assistance, $140?
$140 every 2 weeks. I was feeling so low and so suicidal the other day. I'm like, ain't this nothing. I wish I had AIDS. At least then I get somebody to recognize me and to give me some kind of help.
Well, what are you working on, or what are you working toward?
Trying to get some type of housing and a job. You know, you can have little jobs here and there and stuff.
Red is a homeless woman in San Francisco. That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at poverty in the United States. Thanks for listening. Laura Levati is our managing director. Peggy Law is executive director. Stephanie Welch is associate producer. Our senior advisor is Norman Solomon. David Barsamian is national producer. Shireen Meraji is production assistant. Dean Abdullah is archivist. And I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.